Brain Salad Surgery, Emerson, Lake & Palmer's fourth studio album, was the end result of nearly a year of intensive writing, rehearsal, and touring. Keith Emerson recalls the personal chemistry involved in creating arguably the band's finest album.
Well, you know, ELP were three very competitive individuals, not only in music, but in a lot of other respects as well. Well, you know, when the competition was friendly, everybody would be receptive, and when it wasn't healthy, frankly, it was hell. Brain Salad Surgery, I think, was created at a time when everyone was at their most receptive level, and it hadn't been easy getting there. No ELP album was ever easy in the making. Brain Salad Surgery was the last real ELP album to be made before I embarked upon an orchestral crusade, if you could call it that.
Greg Lake also notes that the album was essentially the end of a very special phase in ELP's career.
I think what people really found appealing about the band was more its fantasy side, and I think that that side of ELP was more predominant in the early albums, Tarkus, Trilogy, and of course Brain Salad Surgery. It's very difficult for me truly to be objective about looking at albums one against another, you know. I can only say I look upon an album rather in the same way as you might look upon a bank check. It's a kind of promise to pay later. And to me, that's what records have always been. It's been a way to communicate without personally being there. And I think Brain Salad Surgery was one among two or three albums that I really think were equally as special as one another in that sort of sense of having some unique music and some interesting and groundbreaking production. And things were going very fast at that point in time.
For Carl Palmer, Brain Salad Surgery represented an unusual junction of talent, timing, and technology.
It was just that moment in time, you know. I think everything was going for us. I think there was an awful lot of technology at the time. I think the polyphonic Moog was around about that time. I think we'd started using quadraphonic round about then, you know, for the live concerts. And the musical design of something like Brain Salad Surgery, that was one of the things that I suppose we've not really captured as much. If one was to look at Emerson, Lake & Palmer and say, what would you play or what album, probably that one would be an album that somebody would want to play and say, hey, that's what they were all about when everything was going their way.
As the album's producer, Greg Lake offers a unique perspective on the sessions for the album.
It's an unusual position from which to produce, because being inside the band itself, it's very difficult to be creative and judicial at the same time. We were pushing the frontiers back there. And so I was always keen on as much innovation, sonic innovation as possible, and would work with Keith on all the synthesizer parts and contributions in that way. And also, I also had a kind of interest in just being a good, solid rock and roll band. And so I think my struggle really was to try and blend those two elements together in a band where all three members, quite honestly, are quite headstrong people.
Keith's massive original Moog console was given a dazzling workout on Toccata, the band's aggressive adaptation of Argentinian composer Alberto Ginastera's first piano concerto. The piece had long fascinated Emerson, who recalls the first pianist he'd heard perform the challenging composition.
João Carlos Martins, I think, was the pianist. He was a pupil of Ginastera, and he was playing on a TV program that the Knights had been invited to by Jack Good in Los Angeles, 1969, I think it was. And this thundering piece of piano work came out of the speakers, and it was just astounding. And I captured him in the corridor, and I said, "What is that?" He said, "Oh," I said, "it is a new piece of music. It's by a very famous Argentinian composer." When I got back to England, I found the record, I bought the record, I bought the music, and sometimes I would play it at blank moments in ELP's rehearsal times. Now, Carl was always very encouraging. If a piece of music had different time signatures in it, he'd be there, he'd say, "Oh, got to do that."
No, it was one of those pieces that took forever to rehearse. It was very, very difficult to follow the tune, you know, and what was going on. It was a piece of music that we all liked instantaneously. It was something that was definitely right for the band. I think it was Keith's idea to put the percussion sort of solo in that.
An earlier tour stop in Switzerland that year had resulted in the band meeting with a then-obscure Zurich-based artist, H.R. Giger, whose masterfully airbrushed cover imagery elevated the Brain Salad Surgery project to another level.
I think we got introduced to Geiger through a chap called Peter Zumsteak in Switzerland, who used to run an agency called Good News. And Peter mentioned to us that there was this artist who we could go along and see. We'd heard vaguely about him, you know. I didn't know too much about him. I think Keith knew more about Geiger.
He had a very small house, but the moment you walked in, my only impression was a bit like having seen a Popeye cartoon, when he goes into Bluto's tent and he sort of looks inside and there's this huge, voluminous place and he looks outside and it's just a tent. That was Giger's house, you know, and it was wall-to-wall artwork. The toilet was scary because all these hands were coming out and you had to sit on these hands while you're doing a shit, you know. Well, we had the working title of Whips and Skull on You at the time. Now, don't ask me why it was called Whips and Skull on You. Well, you can. It was pretty crass, actually. A lot was going down. You know. I'm looking at Giger's paintings, and I see this skull. I think, that's it. And the next day, I get with Greg and Carl, so you've got to see this artist. He's really incredible. It really goes with what we're doing at the moment.
The guy was out there. He showed us a couple of ideas and we thought, oh yes, you know, this is our man. It's a pity he doesn't play an instrument, he could be in the band.
And we walk along and they see the skull and I said, well, there you go. And we said, well, great, Giga, if you can separate that one bit out, we've got the front album cover there. And Greg liked the one of the woman with her eyes closed and the slinky kind of metallic hair hanging down, which turned out to be Giga's wife. What Giga was really proud about, though, was the penis sticking up in front of the lips. We kind of liked that as well. We thought, yeah, okay, that's very rock and roll. We had all these complaints coming back, and they weren't going to release it like that. It was obscene. It was pornographic. Well, I mean, all the band, we stuck up for it, as you say. We stuck up for the penis. But there was no way it wouldn't be released, so I had to call Giger up and I said, look, we have to get rid of the penis. And he said, I'm not getting rid of the penis. The penis stays. No, it has to go, really, because otherwise we have to use something else. And eventually what we had done was an artist to, with an airbrush, gently turn it into a shaft of light.
Greg Lake's balladry, as exemplified by Lucky Man and From the Beginning on earlier albums, was a key element to the band's enduring public appeal.
These songs were the balancing factors that made the thing sit comfortably as an entire album. In the case of Still You Turn Me On, it was really a love song, a kind of love song that brings more of the passion of the music and the feeling of gentleness and tenderness, which a lot of the LP's music does not have. You know, it's extremely aggressive and very metal and very masculine, but not very tender, a lot of it.
The epic three-part Carnival 9 was the centerpiece of Brain Salad Surgery and represents the most extended and complex piece of music in ELP's career.
The first impression of Carnival 9 started out as another attempt at using group counterpoint. All of the music of Carnival 9 was so intricate that we really had to be very close together to relay ideas. When I wrote a lot of Carnival 9, Greg was standing over me on the keyboard and Carl was right behind me on the drums. So I was literally able to say to Greg, okay, we do a G there, you go to this point there. So it was very intimate, the way that we worked.
Early in the album's development, Peter Sinfield, a friend and collaborator from Greg Lake's days in King Crimson, was brought into the ELP fold to add his unique lyrical touch to several songs, including Carnival 9.
It's a play on words, carnival. It was actually carnival, because there was all these bits of music and I couldn't think how to tie them all together. And then it had this sort of carny feel about it, sort of freak feel. And so I saw it as a carnival and I just changed it for the hell of it to carnival. The 9 is because 9 is this odd magical number. Carnival 4 somehow doesn't sit, and carnival 18. I mean, 9 was, it just went with the sort of poetic noise.
Pete and I used to work on the sort of basis where we would drift in and out of reality, you know, we'd drift into a sort of, some of the lyrics would be surreal, and then the next day, it would be maybe that we'd just feel that something needed to be said, for instance, like the way that the media makes money from photographing people suffering, you know, that is just a strange reality of the way human beings are.
The influencers just was Tom Lehrer, because this guy who did this wonderful black humour thing with poisoning pigeons in the park and the old dope peddler and all this stuff. It had an eye for modern society. And what else? Books like Flair Piano and, I don't know, Gormenghast.
The second impression was, I think, complete pianistic percussive showmanship. I'm not sure if it fits any particular form. I remember in the middle, Carl took off pounding away on the tom-toms and I found a sound on the mini-moog which sounded representative of Caribbean steel drums. But, I mean, that's the way that we worked. I remember when Greg sang in the first impression Alexander's Ragtime Band, and I ran out to the piano and overdubbed Tiger Rag, and it fitted perfectly. The third impression was probably very Elgarish, which may have had something to do with the critics calling us all pomp and no circumstance. It wasn't really until the third impression was down that I think Pete mentioned something about using the idea of computers. That appealed to me because we were already being criticised for using the synthesizer on stage, and you know, a lot of critics thought that it was all pre-recorded.
And I think subconsciously a whole bunch of people were worried about them, except that there was a movement going on in California with people, sort of nerdy people, but all those sort of the people that started Apple somewhere, well, it's a bit later than that, but it somehow they had to do with, in theory, a freedom, but a freedom, like all freedoms, that could be abused.
The whole concept of computers dominating people's lives, and the one line, of course, in that says, load your program, I am yourself. And they were rather prophetic words, now I come to think about it. I really do question sometimes how much good it's all doing us, all this bloody technology. And the thing is that that's what brain salad surgery was, to some extent, was about.
I think for us, that whole, you know, from the beginning to that period, to the brain salad surgery, I just think it was an incredibly inventive, creative sort of mode for the band. I think you can have all the greatest technology around you in the world, but at the end of the day, it's the human beings that make the music.
When you've got three musicians like Emerson, Lake and Palmer that were well capable of playing many different styles of music, we chose that opportunity. We just go in and we play whatever we felt like playing, whether it was ragtime, jazz, classical. It was just music that we loved and music that we wanted to play. Sometimes we did it just to excel against each other. Sometimes we did it out of spite for each other. It was music without a beginning. It was music without an end.
The thing is that, you know, we're now coming to the end of the millennium, right? And now it'll be 2001, you know? And one just gets the feeling that one cannot keep thrashing the same old shit out, you know, without something happening. Different things become the focal point of culture at different moments in history. It was a period in music when I think great things were achieved, and I think that it possibly was the end of a very, very special time in modern music.